Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is Crime and Science Radio with very special guest, the FBI, Biotechnology and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Yes, Doug and Jan are pulling back the curtain to give you an inside look into the FBI with very special guests, Betsy Glick, Edward Yu, and Andrew Hessel. This, as Doug says at the beginning, is going to be one of the most entertaining and probably one of the most scary interviews you're going to hear on Crime and Science Radio. And it's actually a two-parter. So today is part one of that interview. And then in 2 weeks, you will hear part two of that interview. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand it off now to our hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone, to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Jan and I are here. We have some wonderful guests here for you today. This is a show that I think will be fascinating, educational, and maybe a little bit scary. The title is Biotechnology and WMDs, and we're interviewing the FBI's Betsy Glick and Edward Yu and Andrew Hessel, who is a biotech futurist. Betsy is an underachiever like the two gentlemen that are with her today. And first, I want to thank her for getting Andrew and Ed on the show. But Betsy graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with cum laude honors and also took courses at the infamous and famous Wharton and Annenberg Institutes. She cut her teeth in the communications director of the National World War II Memorial and the VP Marketing and Communications at Drug Free Kids Campaign, as well as a couple of advertising agencies. For the past 10 years, she has been with the FBI in the Office of Public Affairs. But what's interesting, and I met her at ThorFest, the ITW conference, because she works with screenwriters and authors and producers and directors to kind of show them how they can interface with the right individuals so that stories and movies and what can at least portray the FBI properly. I know Hollywood and writers don't always do that, but it's not Betsy's fault. Our other guest is Edward Yu, who is a supervisory special agent with the FBI's Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate, the Biological Countermeasure Unit. And it's disturbing that there has to be someone who does what it does, but in this day and age, there is. But he works to coordinate the FBI and other agencies to identify, assess, and respond to biological threats. And he has a pretty extensive background in that he was with the FBI field office in Los Angeles in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and also was on the FBI's Hazardous Evidence Response Team. I bet that was fun. And he works with various other organizations, including the National Security Council Policy Committee for Countering Biological Threats, which also sounds scary. Our last guest, we're going to have a great time because we've got a good group here today, and we're going to be going backwards and forth, is Andrew Hessel. And he's a futurist and a catalyst for biological technologies. He's a co-founder of Pink Army Cooperative, which is the world's first cooperative biotechnology company. Before that, he was the co-chair of bioinformatics and biotechnology at Singularity University. And currently, he's a distinguished researcher with Autodesk, Inc.'s Bio and Nanotechnology Group. He's also been active in DIY Bio, which is do-it-yourself bio. There's a whole community out there of people working in this thing, and Andrew's been involved with them. And he works tirelessly to inspire other students and to bring along other entrepreneurs. So, Betsy, Ed, and Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're really glad to have you guys here. Betsy, I have a couple of things for you. You know, first of all, as I said, I want to thank you for bringing Ed and Andrew to the show. And when we talked in New York, you highly recommended them, and particularly their field of expertise, which I said is kind of scary. But before we get into to that world and get into all of that, tell us about your position at the FBI, and particularly in how you work with researchers and writers and people doing everything from movies and novels to documentaries. How does that work? Most people think they can't approach the FBI.
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. The FBI is interested in what fiction writers write about in their books, because if you look at, for example, at the movie Shooter, it was based on a novel by Stephen Hunter, and then you have Mark Wahlberg has successfully sold it into a television show. So if there were something drastically incorrect or detrimental to the FBI in the book, it's going to be in the movie and it's going to be in the television show. So we like to work with writers, even when they're writing fiction, to help them accurately portray us. And why do we do that? Because how does the FBI solve crimes? We solve crimes when people are willing to talk to an agent when he knocks on their door. And if all the people see in the movies or in pop culture are negative and wrong antagonistic portrayals, they're not going to cooperate. So our mission is to build the trust of the American people so that they can help us solve our operational mission.
So it's a very practical thing as well as informational.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's I get to meet all kinds of people like you, and I've worked with Hollywood television show writers and directors. And, you know, as you mentioned, I went to Annenberg. My goal in life was always to be a part of, you know, mass communications. And I never imagined that I would be at the FBI. I always thought I'd be at a television station or working, as you said, in that agency. But I'm doing exactly what I do, just from a different angle. So it's a win-win for everybody.
Well, you know, we're going to have all this stuff on the website, but what's the best way people can reach you and ask their questions? And should they be afraid? I mean, should they just jump in and ask the question? If I contact the FBI, they're going to put me on a watch list.
You've been watching too many TV
shows.
Yeah, that's funny. All authors or writers need to do, we have an email address, and we have a web page on the FBI website. They just simply write a note to this address, public.affairs@C, that stands for Internet Communications, .fbi.gov. I'll go again real quick, public.affairs@ic.fbi.gov. And so just put a short note, who you are, what the questions that you have are, maybe like a three-sentence summary of the book or the project you're working on, so we get a flavor for why you are looking for FBI assistance with your plot or your characters, and we're happy to try to set you up. If the story's based in Miami, we'll try to set you up with someone in Miami or L.A. or Chicago, and, you know, again, just to help lend authenticity to your portrayal, and we're happy to do it. And no, we will not put you on any kind of watch list. Unless you keep asking, classified questions. No, otherwise, you're good.
It is amazing how often I get that question. But I'm afraid to do this because they'll tag me. No, they won't. They know I'm interested in you. Trust me.
I'm actually required to destroy your personal information once I answer your question, so you're safe.
Just to follow up on this one, what Doug just asked, is there a certain level of homework you wish people would do before they contact you, or places where people can get good basic information before they get to the specialized information that you'd be getting from you?
That's a great question. The FBI website is so full of information on closed cases, on what different specialties within the FBI are doing. so we would actually like for writers to try to start at FBI.gov and look for information, and when you write to us, tell us specifically what you're looking for. You know, come up with your crime scene or your action, and then come with a specific question rather than an open hand saying, I want to do something, you know, very general and ask us to, you know, fill it in. We just want to help you connect the dots. So show us what the dots are, and we'll help you connect them.
Okay. Well, let's also find out a little bit more about Supervisory Special Agent Ed Yu. Ed, you moved from studying bioscience at UCI to dealing with synthetic bio-WMTs and terrorism at the FBI. That's quite a journey. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So, I got my bachelor's degree from the University of California at Irvine in the biological sciences. I then continued on to graduate school, where I got my master's degree in biochemistry and molecular biology. Worked for several years in human gene therapy, so basically utilizing viruses and potentially using them as delivery vehicles for therapeutic genes to treat certain diseases. But then 9/11 happened, and I think that was a seminal moment, not only for myself, but for our entire generation. And that sort of galvanized me. Once I finished graduate school, I went on to go work at Amgen, where Andrew and I both have linkages there, but worked there for a few years in cancer research and, you know, decided to go into more direct public service and apply to the FBI. And to my surprise, very quickly got responded and was given an Academy start date at the FBI New Agent class, and effectively hung up the lab coat and put on a badge.
Mm. So you trained actually as a agent, field agent first, or?
I went through 4 months of New Agent training. It was definitely a culture shift coming from being a lab rat to then being formally introduced to hand-to-hand combat, firearms, and legal proceedings. But very proud of the fact that I completed that training, and thereupon was assigned to Los Angeles field office, where I was able to do exactly what I signed up to the FBI, is to work counterterrorism investigations to prevent another 9/11 from ever happening again. Did that for 4 years. I also, as an agent, had the opportunity to have collateral duty where you volunteer for extra services. That could be performing on a SWAT team. I elected to do hazardous SS response, so I didn't want my science training to become completely stale. So based on that performance, I was promoted to my current position as a supervisory special agent and was transferred to FBI headquarters here in Washington, D.C., and been working in the Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate now for the last 6 years.
Mm-hmm. And Andrew, tell us a bit about your background and how you became involved with biotechnology and bioinformatics or informatics, and tell us sort of what is bioinformatics?
Yeah, I'm happy to share this. So I'll just start with what bioinformatics is, and it's basically using computer tools to analyze biological information. As you can believe, this is generally not off-the-shelf software for most people, and so a lot of the tools are written by the researchers themselves, and there's a variety of different programs and algorithms that have been developed over the years. My entry point into this started really with my interest in computers. I was about 16, 17 years old when I started buying computers and started learning how to program and use them. Really found them fascinating. But when I started to actually think about what my career path would be, I realized I really wasn't interested so much in computers and computer software themselves. I wanted to use it in a more powerful way than just writing programs. And so I decided that I would move into life science. I looked at biology as being really important and really valuable and really mysterious. Cellular and molecular biology was still making foundational discoveries. so I started shifting my training into cellular and molecular biology, and it was at a really interesting time. It was when the DNA sequencing really started to take off. Better sequencing technology for reading DNA code had been developed, and it was generating a fair amount of data. And really, for the first time, computers started to be used in the life science lab to analyze genetic code. And so I started writing computer programs to do that type of analysis, and one thing led to another. I ended up being recognized for doing bioinformatics work, and a lot of it was just building databases and organizing information, but some of it was doing foundational discovery and analysis, and there weren't many people in the field when I started. It's continued to be central now in as life science has become more and more digital and more genetic data and things like medical health records, et cetera, have all started to become digitized over the last 20 or 25 years.
Well, so how do you two know each other? Because you're really not in, you didn't really come from identical, you know, both in biology to some degree, but very different branches. So how did you come to know each other?
As part of the W&D Directorate, part of our mission space is to address some of the emerging issues. And when I came to the W&D Directorate back in 2008, identified synthetic biology as a really powerful emerging field. And one of the things I did from the outset was facilitate and host the first ever FBI Synthetic Biology Conference. And I hope you can appreciate that for just a second, because that is a seminal moment for the Bureau, because I don't think anybody ever would have thought to see FBI and synthetic biology put together in the same sentence as well as host a conference on that, which we did do in partnership with the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which was very important because they're the publishers of Science Magazine. It's an international scientific journal that scientists around the world are very much trying to get their work published in. So that joint partnership, we brought in members of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Directorate, which I can talk a little bit more about later on, and key representatives from the synthetic biology field, which included absolutely Andrew, and members from this growing nascent field of amateur biologists, as well as some of the key leaders in industry. And really the challenge of that meeting was recognizing that there is a lot of very important beneficial applications and technologies coming out of this field. What can we do in the near term to identify any possible security concerns, and then working to collaboratively find ways to mitigate them and establish very important relationships, which evolved into where Andrew and I sit now in our partnership.
Andrew, do you have anything to say about that?
I remember the first time that I met Ed, and it was really a remarkable connection, because I'd never had any crossover with law enforcement or the FBI, and we'd by intersecting within this new community of scientists, I just thought it was remarkable that Ed was doing outreach. So I just had to learn more about Ed. As he said, we shared this background, that we both worked for the same biopharma company. So there was an instant connection there. And I had taken a very different path in it when I left the company, really helping to inspire and get people connected to this emerging community of bioengineers and developers, and just to find someone that had, you know, kind of started from the same place and come at it from a law enforcement perspective, I just thought was fascinating. It was the start of a long-term relationship and friendship.
Cool. Well, let's get into some nuts and bolts of what you guys do and know and et cetera. obviously I was a pre-med student. I majored in chemistry and minored in biology. So I took a lot of these science classes in college as well as med school. But one of my favorite by far was molecular biology, which you mentioned earlier. So what the heck is synthetic biology? How does this work, and how would you define it, and how did this come about?
Yeah, synthetic biology, it really has an unfortunate name in some way, because all of biology is really organic.
Right.
So, but synthetic biology was a new branch of genetic engineering that has really been empowered by computer-aided design tools and the idea of building robust and reliable systems for engineering biology. And at the heart of this technology is kind of an understanding that the living cell is a machine that has mechanisms that can be understood and that has essentially software that runs this machine, DNA or the genome. And synthetic biology is about essentially learning how to write programs for this incredible machine. So it's really bringing some of the ideas and abstractions and understanding from the IT world, essentially the electronic computers, and starting to bring them into the field of life sciences, genetic engineering. It's really taking the idea of programming cells and engineering software into the life science for the first time. And the whole idea is to be able to get these remarkable machines, the cell, to work and run, do things in a reliable, robust, and reproducible way.
So this led to you being the co-founder of the Peak Army Cooperative. What is that, and what does it really do?
The Pink Army Cooperative is in many ways an experiment. When I learned a very important lesson working in the biopharmaceutical industry, which is it's very hard to make new drugs for society. It's common knowledge that this is a long, slow, and expensive process. Typically, the numbers that are communicated are somewhere in the order of $1 to $2 billion to develop a new drug. Timelines that are on the order of 10 to 20 years in some cases, and as such, the innovation and the introduction of new drugs is a really slow and methodical process with a lot of checks and balances. In a good year, 30 drugs will be approved. On a bad year, 20 drugs will be approved. So the Pink Army Cooperative was really an examination of how we might bring some of the ideas that were emerging from community-based development, open source, and mobilizing groups of people to try and solve puzzles in a community-based way. And so I realized that every pharmaceutical company in the world was essentially proprietary. They were all trying to make drugs for a mass market. They were all trying to make a profit. So I thought, well, what if we just made a very different type of company? What if we did exactly the opposite of what every other drug company in the world is doing? Instead of making it proprietary, let's make it open. Instead of locking information away, let's share it transparently. Let's instead of making drugs for a lot of people, why not turn it around and try and make drugs for just one person at a time? Which made a lot of sense for what we were learning about cancer, that no two cancers are exactly the same. And rather than trying to make a medicine and sell it for profit, why not see if we couldn't leverage some of the open source and ideas and see if we couldn't make it as inexpensive or as possible or possibly even free. So it was really a complete experiment to see if this might work. And at the heart of it was the idea of using synthetic biology, this powerful new computer-aided design platform to make medicines, in this case, in the cooperative's case, to try and address breast cancer.
So it brings up the question of Autodesk, where you're involved now. People probably don't know what that is. Can you tell us what it is, how it works, and what you guys are doing?
Yes, Autodesk is a company that is a world leader in design, engineering, simulation, and visualization software. It's probably best known for its AutoCAD product, which was developed in the 1980s, computer-aided design first used in architecture. Today we have hundreds of software titles that are sold into professional markets, design, engineering, visualization, as well as a fast-growing consumer division that makes design software for things like 3D printers. So it's diversified, it's global, about 8,000 employees, and we operate in almost every area of product design and engineering.
Excellent.
So part of what you deal with is the subject of synthetic viruses. Why would you or anyone make a synthetic virus, and what would be its uses and abuses?
Well, I want to just back up one step. You know, at Autodesk, we make these design tools, but what we've recognized is that it's really important that design tools get connected to output devices, printers, if we really want to complete the digital design and digital manufacturing process. And at the heart of synthetic biology is a specialized machine called a DNA synthesizer. It's really a device that can print new DNA. This is the reason why it's becoming easier to do genetic engineering. There is an emerging class of bioinformatics software specialized for doing genetic design, and we have this machine that can now print genetic code rather than having to manipulate genetic code at a lab bench. We can just physically print the code. So the thing is, these machines are pretty new. The chemistry has been around for 40-odd years, but the machines themselves could only print very short segments of DNA. So it's kind of like you could only write a sentence or a paragraph. You couldn't really write a whole book. So I was interested in how to the intersection of design software with these DNA printers. And many people were starting to use them to make very small constructs, genetic constructs that would be sufficient to make a single protein or a few steps in a metabolic pathway. But I started focusing on what are the smallest whole genomes that can be synthesized, and these are the viruses. So the very first synthetic genome ever made was made in 2002, and this really woke people up to the idea that a synthetic that a virus can be completely engineered just from writing genetic code and then putting that genetic code into a suitable host cell, and then that cell would then make the virus and shown to be completely identical to the natural virus. So I got really interested in the evolution of these DNA printing technologies and the design technologies, and started to focus my own work at Autodesk on understanding, can we build design tools and processes for making these designer viruses? Now, I want to be very clear. We work with one single virus that called PhyX174 that has already been made synthetically by other scientists in 2003. I wanted to see if I could replicate that work using modern technologies and whether we could build more intuitive and accessible design tools for this type of work so that we could improve the process. And in fact, we were able to demonstrate last year that we could, in fact, do that. Now, why you would want to make a virus? Well, there's multiple uses. There's things like vaccines. When you get vaccinated, often they use what's called an attenuated virus, a very weak version of the virus that is enough to stimulate your immune system to produce protection but won't get you sick. On the forward edge, viruses are used as modern cancer therapies, both to infect cancer cells with a weak virus that would otherwise be shut down by normal cells, or as immunotherapy to train your immune system to hunt down a virus or a cancer in your body. Use the virus to essentially deliver a new program to your immune system. And then there's things like gene therapies, which can actually be used to repair a defect in a cell and by bringing in kind of a repair to the genetic program of that cell. Those are just a few examples, but there's many more. Viruses are very powerful agents in the environment and play important roles that we're still understanding. So in general, this technology could be used to advance research and development in virology, epidemiology, therapeutics, and diagnostics.
And it sounds also like ultimately, possibly in dealing with aging, life extension, things like that as well.
That is a really forward-looking application of these technologies, although I'm sure people would find that very interesting.
Oh. Pretty amazing stuff, and so these are viable living microorganisms that are essentially printed from a 3D printer. Or am I not understanding what's going on?
Let me walk you through the process. We've been sequencing viruses for decades now, and that gives us the genetic code of the virus. So that's sort of essentially taking the chemical information in the DNA and turning it into an electronic file on a computer. That's essentially what DNA sequencing is. Read the chemical, turn it into a digital file on the computer. In this case, we're going the other direction. We're taking a digital file on a computer that specifies the viral genome and using the DNA synthesizer to turn it back into the chemical program. Now, it is just a segment of DNA that encodes information. But it's really important information. It's actually enough information to actually make a whole viral particle. So if we take that genetic code and we put it into a host cell, in this case, an E. coli bacterium, if we take the PHYX-174 DNA and we put it into an E. coli bacterium, the mechanisms inside that bacterial cell, all of the stuff that's normally reading and executing the genetic instructions of the bacterium, will start to recognize the genetic instructions for the virus. And all of the cellular machinery will start to work and make virus particles. And so it's really using the host cell, in this case E. coli, as a 3D printer for the virus. So it's kind of a two-step process. One is to take the digital code of the genome and synthesize the DNA. So we call that printing the DNA. And then taking that DNA and putting it into a cell and then using the cell as a printer to make the virus. And at the end of the day, you end up with the biological virus. Now, I do want to be clear on one point. A virus technically is not alive. A virus is a lot like remember when you used to get software on a CD-ROM or on a DVD drive? that's kind of what a virus is. It's kind of a bit of software in a container. Think of it as the box that the CD would come in if you bought it at a software store, you know, back, you know, 10 years ago. So the box tells, instructs what computer the disk will run on, you know, whether it's a bacterial cell or a human cell or an animal cell. And then the genetic instructions inside, if it gets it into the proper host cell, will start to execute. The software will run. But the virus itself is not alive unless it has a host cell. It's actually an inert object.
I think that's well explained, and I think a lot of people don't understand that viruses are basically just little protein balls that have a strand of DNA or RNA inside them, and they have to hijack a cell, and then they use the mechanisms of the cell. So obviously, you know, this obviously is the groundwork and the floor of gene therapy, where you can actually create a bit of DNA, have it injected into a cell, and rewrite the book. It's like editing your novel. You don't like that sentence, change it to another sentence. And I know that research is going on in sickle cell and cystic fibrosis and organ rejection and a lot of stuff as far as gene therapy, even in cholesterol management, to change the genetics of certain cells of the body so that certain things don't happen or aren't produced or produced in a different way. So there's a lot of good out there, but obviously, since we're pretty dark people on this show, we always think of the worst because we are crime fighters at the end of the day, too. So the term dual-use biotechnology, obviously, it comes up that what can be good can also be used for bad. Can each of you kind of discuss that concept a little bit?
Sure. I can address that question. As you mentioned, dual use is you know, legitimate search or application that could be flipped and potentially used for nefarious criminal use. Actually, the term dual use and specifically dual use research of concern is a very hot topic even today. Back in 2012, there were two publications that came out, one in the journal Science, another one in Nature. Two separate group, research groups, one in the University of Wisconsin-Madison and another one at the Erasmus Medical Center in the Netherlands. These two separate groups manipulated and modified avian influenza virus, specifically H5N1, to potentially be transmissible amongst mammals. So they were able to show ferret-to-ferret transmission. That's key because avian influenza, as the name describes, it's usually just isolated to the wild bird or a fowl population. It's currently circulating in China. And there have been one-off infections where an individual may be working in a wild bird market and get exposed, and there's that that infection jump. And the interesting thing about that is of the cases, which are not that many, but those who have come down with infection, about 60% of them died. And that's somewhat remarkable because by comparison, if you look at the U.S., every year there's about 30,000 fatalities in the U.S. from the seasonal flu. And that's a very large number, especially if you compare that to the current Ebola epidemic going on in Africa. But that's basically just barely a percentage point. And so if you think about that, if we're looking at 30,000 fatalities from just a percentage point, and now you're dealing with H5N1, which has a 60% fatality rate, that's significant. It's an order of magnitude at least. But the aspect is because there's that one jump to a human, it does not get passed on to another human. So stop there. But you can imagine that if flu is mutating every day, I mean it's really pernicious in its ability to mutate itself, and that's why we have to undergo seasonal flu vaccinations, and even that's a crapshoot if they have the right.
Exactly.
So the when these two research groups came out with, hey, we've identified the five necessary mutations to show that we can modify bird flu to now be transmissible amongst mammals, so now you go beyond just the one human, now you can pass it from, you know, theoretically from human to human, that caused a huge outcry, because now what did you just do? You engineered a modified virus that could potentially cause a pandemic. I should note that synthetic biology was not used as a research tool in both cases, but that caused a huge debate on dual use, on certain risk-benefit calculations need to go into conducting certain types of research. So that is still being debated at the policy level amongst the different federal government agencies, and even rose to the level of being discussed at the World Health Organization. So the whole topic of dual-use research concern is still very germane even as we speak.
And I'm happy to jump in here and just and really just note that I look at all technology as being dual use, potentially being in the right hands can be used in a very constructive way, in the wrong hands in a destructive way. So in some ways, really the technology is agnostic. It's really about human intention. And biotechnology is a very powerful technology. We know that. It, living things are this is a living world, and this is a single access point into manipulating or engineering living systems. In fact, I got I was asked so many times about, isn't this dangerous? Isn't this dangerous? When really, when you think about it, biology is the one technology that works pretty much flawlessly most of the time. I really wish my computer system was as reliable as my cat, that type of thing. I actually ended up saying, well, let's explore the darkest side of this. For example, cancer researchers have been working to develop essentially targeted therapies for cancer. This is the gold standard, being able to make a chemical or biological agent that can specifically target a broken cell, a malignant cell in a patient. And that's a really hard job, because the malignant cell is in fact a derivative of the patient's normal cells. But they're developing all these technologies for specific targeting and killing of particular cells. So I wrote a piece for The Atlantic in 2012 where I basically put forward the idea that this technology, the expertise being developed by the cancer community, could be co-opted and the tools of synthetic biology co-opted to make a personalized bioweapon. Because targeting an individual in a population is theoretically easier than targeting an individual's cancer cell in their body. And so I wrote a piece on called Hacking the President's DNA and put forward the hypothetical scenario of a targeted bioweapon being directed against the president. And not that I want to see this happen, but I wanted to address directly kind of the worst-case scenario of these technologies and some of the greatest fears in society about how they could be abused, and just raise awareness that this is, a theoretical threat, kind of a worst-case scenario, but one that, is certainly a great discussion point and perhaps even a future movie. And I wasn't surprised when that story was optioned by Hollywood to be developed as a script one day.
And Andrew brings up a really important point, is the focus on intent on dual use. So as I mentioned, as a U.S. government policy, they classify dual use research of concern as research being conducted on 15 specific types of agents. With certain types of experiments, so it's list-based. But you should know that the separation between policy and what the FBI does as a law enforcement agency, We actually have federal criminal statutes preventing the misuse of biological materials. Specifically, there are two that are, I think, as relevant as Title 18 of the U.S. Code 175, subparagraph A and subparagraph B, and they're burned into my brain because that's important for us. That's the rules of the road for us. So the first part is use of any biological agent or toxin for use as a weapon, and the second one is possession of any biological agent or toxin without a bona fide, legitimate, peaceful research purpose. And so that, if you think about it, that goes to the very heart, the nature of intent. Because as Andrew mentioned, biology research in itself is already, I mean, you know, the basis is legitimate, but we're looking at the potential misuse. So, for example, say I had a raging case of the flu, and Doug, you just really pissed me off. And when you're not looking, I grab your phone, I lick it, or I lick your computer keyboard when you're not looking, and you're toast. You're done. You're going to get sick no matter what. Can you prove, especially to a court, that I had the intent to get you sick, that I perpetrated an assault on your person? All I can say is, well, you know, it was just tough luck because I had a highly communicable disease. You know, unless you actually have a video recording of me doing that, it is very difficult to prove. So it is incredibly difficult to prove intent, unless that you happen to decide to try to mail rice into the president, which actually so the intent is implied. It's implicit there. So I can talk a little bit more about that later, but. But the fact of the matter is that we actually do have federal laws that promote and protect legitimate scientific research, but we really are on the lookout for the intentional misuse and exploitation for criminal acts for important biological works and products. So that's why in that vein, we have to develop important partnerships. You know, we don't work in this field alone. So important part of this is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. We absolutely are fantastic partners with them. We established a training program that our directorate provides to state and local law enforcement and state and local public health. So in the interest of to look at intent, say, for example, in your local town or city, there's an unusual outbreak of some kind. Our training provides folks at that level to work together to rapidly determine, hey, is this a naturally occurring event or was this intentional? So that goes to the very heart of the discussion on dual use, and I'm very glad that Andrew mentioned this, the focus on intent.
Yeah, and Andrew also mentioned that a lot of this is speculative, but, I mean, to my mind, it's really not all that speculative anymore. I mean, as far as we've moved down this road, just as you say, in the last 20 years, I mean, it's scary from where we were, 1990 to now. It's a quantum leap. And as someone who grew up with Jules Verne, you know, if you can dream it, it will happen at some point in time. So my question is, can you really buy smallpox DNA on the internet?
Well, that actually sort of happened. In 2006, there was a reporter for The Guardian, and for whatever reason, it's always those darn pesky reporters. But this reporter used a personal credit card, his personal email address, and submitted by email, a sequence of DNA, those A's, G's, and T's, to a company, a DNA synthesis firm. And a little over a month, he got his order in the mail, a little plastic vial, and inside the vial was indeed a DNA sequence for smallpox. And his ensuing story was that the laws and regulations are not in place to prevent a bad guy or terrorist from ordering smallpox in the mail. Yes, there was some truth in that, but it should be known that although there was smallpox DNA, there were only 86 bases worth. And smallpox, the viral genome is over 200,000 bases long, so it was completely harmless. And that caused a whole huge firestorm of policy discussions, as you can imagine. But that also impacted the entire industry, in that now companies screen incoming orders. They screen the DNA orders to determine what it is they're making, and they also screen the customers to determine who they're selling it to. So, and this was not, there is no specific requirement or regulation that exists to this day. This was a voluntary action by the entire private sector to do their due diligence in protecting and preventing that type of scenario from happening again.
Amazing. Well, we're going to take a break here, and then we'll be back with Betsy and Ed and Andrew shortly. Thanks for listening so far.